My name's Shadi, and today I'm going to be talking about building descent networks. And this is some joint work that I've done with my colleagues, Yahel Ben-David, Julia Fonte, Eric Brewer, and Scott Schenker, and all of us are over at UC Berkeley. So the problem we're talking about today are large-scale communications blackouts. And as most of you will remember, in 2011, Egypt shut the whole country off the internet. And this is a graph reminding us they did it all in 30 minutes. And while this was kind of a unthinkable event at the time because of all the collateral damage inflicted, other countries have carried out similar actions in the years since, most notably Syria just this summer. And so since 2011, there's been a lot of interest in building tools to circumvent these blackout events from a bunch of organizations, including the State Department. And the motivation for our work grew out of the interest that my co-authors and I have in this space, but also our concern with some of the leading proposals the leading proposed solutions. So what we're going to try to do today is provide a critical look at those proposals and attempt to start a discussion on design imperatives for people who are trying to build these large-scale blackout circumvention systems. So to kind of frame the discussion a bit, what we're talking about is communications infrastructure for dissidents that exists in-country communication. It's not getting videos out. You know, we need to build alternate physical infrastructure when our internet connection's been cut off. And so we're talking about things like Commotion, Serval, Freedom Tower, et cetera, which are actually projects targeted towards building alternative infrastructure as opposed to Tor, VPNs, or whatever that only work if you already have an existing internet connection. So let's put ourselves in the shoes now of someone who's in Egypt in January 2011, and the internet's just been cut off. So what are we going to do now? There's lots of things we could do. Arguably, the right one is take to the streets and demand political change, but we're all technologists here. We like to build our way out of problems. So I'm sure some of you are thinking, let's go about building a mesh network. Some of you are also thinking, I didn't realize that was still a thing. I thought that went away, but as of last week, it is still a thing. And for those who don't know what mesh networks are, why we might want to build them, they're basically these infrastructure-free networks that consist of a bunch of wireless devices, usually with directional antennas. We call the devices nodes. And they have this really nice property that they are self-healing and self-forming. We have these routing protocols that figure out the right way to connect all these nodes together, and they automatically make paths to the network so we can communicate. It has this nice property where if one node gets taken over by an evil spy or gets blown up and goes away, we can just route around the damage, and everything's hunky-dory. So if we want to build this network, we have to ask ourselves a few questions. First off, how is it going to grow? We have a couple of choices here. For traditional networks, we plan their growth. We figure out where we're going to put new devices, how we're going to connect them, are we going to line up antennas in a certain way. But with mesh networks, because of the self-forming property, we can also let them grow organically. So we can just distribute nodes as we're able to, and the network will just form itself, and it can grow organically. The next question is how we're going to manage it. Again, traditional networks typically have a single person or a group of people who make decisions for the whole network, about network policy, how they fix when things break, you know, how it gets fixed. But in a mesh network, the infrastructure is completely distributed. It could be distributed over multiple people. So we can actually have different people who are in charge of different parts of the network making their own decisions independently. And finally, we have to decide what the topology of the network is going to be like. Is it going to be a static, are all the nodes going to be stationary, or are we going to allow for infrastructure nodes that move around, like mobile phones? And I want to emphasize that you can pick any point in this whole design space and build a mesh network, and people have done it. There's examples of all of these. But if we're activists, then we probably want to have the properties of organic growth, decentralized management, and mobile topology, simply because that seems like it's going to be harder to shut down. Our government adversary, on the other hand, has already proven its ability to shut down planned and centralized networks. They've shut off the internet, after all. So in thinking about this, you know, this is the contribution of our work. We're trying to outline these design imperatives for people who are building these systems. And I think these kind of come out of our thinking on what it means to build a successful mesh network. And so we call these descent networks, and they need to be resilient to disruption, obviously, because that's the whole point of what we're trying to build. But more than that, they need to have meaningful scalability properties. If we're in a revolution environment, opportunity costs matter. And more than that, we have lots of other options for communicating with our activist friends. Megaphones are surprisingly good, tools for communicating over our local area. when we're actually putting together the equipment for this network, we're going to have to stage it in country beforehand, or we're going to have to somehow scrounge together the equipment once the revolution's already started. So the components need to be innocuous. They can't get us in trouble. We're already taking a risk by building this thing. We should try to minimize that. And finally, it should these networks need to resist tracking. We don't want to provide another mechanism for the government to track us. So, you know, if the first objective was the only one, mesh networks might make sense. But unfortunately, they failed to meet some other criteria. So I'm just going to walk through some of those reasons right now. And the core one is this. It comes from a really foundational result from a 2000 paper by Gupta and Kumar about the capacity of wireless networks. And basically what it shows is as you add nodes to a mesh network, the capacity available to each node approaches zero. So it actually gets worse as the network grows. And they even provide the helpful advice that perhaps we should target efforts at designing small networks to get around this problem. But it's not just a theoretical problem. You know, more than that, in 2001, Jin-Yan Lee and her colleagues at MIT actually validated some of this result experimentally with simulations. And one of the many experiments in their paper is this one, where if you imagine your mesh network to be a big chain of nodes, where each node can communicate only with its neighbors, as you increase the length of the chain, the throughput that you get through the chain actually drops off significantly. It gets worse as the network gets larger. So, you know, there's like an obvious result from this. Maybe we can't use mesh networks to send large files, sure. But maybe small things will work. And that turns out not to be the case either, because the fundamental reason for these poor scaling properties is channel contention. So let's walk through posting a tweet. All right, we have this nice 9-node mesh network. Our tweet fits in a single packet, and we're going to get a single packet back in response. So if we're using omnidirectional antennas, as most mesh networks do in order to increase resilience, you know, our node A is going to transmit to all its neighbors, and node B is going to receive an identical, you know, radiation pattern. It's going to be able to receive from any direction as well. That also means it's susceptible to interference from any direction, which is a bad thing, because in order for our first wireless hop to succeed, no other nodes can be transmitting at the same time. If they are, it will fail. We'll have to retransmit. And similarly for the second hop, and we have an identical problem for the response in both directions. Now, obviously, this is not how real networks work. You have to set up a TCP connection first. That's another wireless round trip. If you want to do something over SSL, that's two more at least. So we're talking about a minimum of four round trips for each tweet that we want to send. We want to send more tweets. It gets worse and worse. So things fall apart pretty quickly. And so, you know, I'm glossing over some details, and it's possible to build networks that get larger. You know, you can do things to get around the Gupta and Kumar result. You can use directional antennas or introduce mobility or have multi-radio nodes to reduce the amount of channel contention you have in the network. But all of these come at a cost, whether it's in terms of resilience or whether it's just in pure money terms. You can accept the Gupta and Kumar result and incorporate delay tolerance into the applications you're going to run on the network, or just build smaller networks like they actually suggest. But this reduces the efficacy of the network, and also hurts the user experience if your applications aren't designed for it. Or you can result to central planning and coordinated management to try to mitigate the amount of channel contention you have in your network. But then we're back to building networks that are easy for the government to shut down. So, okay, we tried to build this basic mesh network. It didn't work. But maybe there's some practical modifications that we can make. Or maybe there are other systems we can use. First one that comes to mind are satellite. And the great thing about satellite networks is that they're really easy to deploy. You just point it up at the sky, and it works. We know it works. Journalists use these all the time. Military use them all the time. Many of you have used these. But as anyone who has used them know, satellite internet access is expensive, and it's slow. Moreover, the equipment for, you know, the client equipment you need is not exactly in every electronic shop in every corner. It's hard to source. And in some countries, it's illegal to even operate without registration. And more than that, it's easy to trace and jam. And so from a technical perspective, you know, you could probably get around some of these drawbacks, but you're still going to build this system that's not going to scale, you know, to the large numbers that we really want without spending a lot of money or doing something. So what we really want is maybe something like an internet in a suitcase that we could just open up and we get internet access. And this reminds us kind of our third criteria about using innocuous components. So there's a few things in here that look pretty normal, that no one may know what the CD is anymore. but everything else you'd expect to find in someone's apartment. These are, you know, Wi-Fi radios. They look a little weird, but they're actually pretty common throughout the world. But where we start to run into problems is when you have, you know, these other two components. When was the last time that you saw someone with a sector antenna that wasn't a cell phone tower? And speaking of cell phone towers, you know, there's been proposals to run pirate cellular networks by activists. And this is just a bad idea all around, because in every country on Earth, with the exception of the Netherlands, operating an unlicensed or unauthorized cell phone network is going to get you in a lot of trouble. Stay away from it. And even if we're not talking about illegal equipment necessarily, you know, legal stuff can still get you in trouble. One of my co-authors, Yahel, founded this great organization called Airjaldi. And what it builds is, you know, wireless networks throughout India. It started in northern India in Dharamsala. And basically, when they started out, they had, within a few years, built what was the largest wireless mesh network in Asia, probably in the world. And this picture is of one of their towers. Everything about it is 100% legal. But Yahel's actually been arrested under suspicion of espionage for going around and setting these up in people's rooms. They just look weird. They're going to get you in trouble. They're very conspicuous. So maybe you can find a way around this too. And let's say we actually successfully build one of these networks. What about anonymity? I was told to say federal employees should close their eyes. You know, once you build an effective network, government's going to want to attack it. It's a really valuable resource for an adversary. They can use it to gather intelligence. They can use it to figure out social connections between activists. They can use it to infiltrate and spread misinformation. And all of the things that we want to prevent. Or some of these problems are questions of communication secrecy. You know, we can solve some of it with encryption, but you know, we really contend that descent networks should also think about anonymity in their design. And I want to, I guess, just say up front, we don't have an answer to this. We're not, it's a hard problem. We aren't proposing a solution here, but it's a design criteria that we haven't seen discussed enough in any of the leading solutions. So open your eyes, federal employees. So let's talk about ways to keep users safe. You know, one way we can do this is with providing real anonymity guarantees in our wireless, in our networks, whatever we're building. You know, pseudonymity is insufficient here. We know we can de-anonymize pseudonymous systems. There's attacks in the Bitcoin network, et cetera. And this is a particular threat, given our adversary is a state. They're going to have lots of external information about us so they can cross-correlate with our network activity. Now, the problem, of course, of providing true anonymity in one of these systems is really, really hard to build. And moreover, if you were to provide real anonymity, having so much trouble with that word, you're going to lose the ability to provide reputation. Your activists and who are using this need to know that they're able to trust information that's coming across the network. So another approach is deniability. And this is, you know, something that we see in other systems. Tor, for instance, there's lots of legitimate uses of Tor. Just because they're using Tor doesn't mean you're taking down a government. And so you can imagine other approaches like Telex uses, where we have traffic that might get us in trouble that we're going to hide inside, you know, innocuous traffic. And you know, this is a nice approach too. There are systems where this works in practice, but it's still kind of sketchy because it's hard to take these concepts of deniability over to building real infrastructure networks where just your participation is incriminating. You set up a node. You had to actively go and do this. That's going to get you in trouble. And moreover, if we're going to have non-activist traffic across our network, that's going to increase load. And if we're already in a resource-constrained environment, that's a bad thing. So you know, the real answer is probably some combination of these, maybe something else. Like I said, we don't have answers. This is a hard problem. So I painted a kind of grim picture here. But we think there's some ways forward. You know, we know how to build systems that protect people's identities really well. Tor is a great example. Descent's a good example. We're going to hear about some more work this afternoon. That's you know kind of similar to Descent. And you know some lessons from this might be able to carry over to circumventing large-scale blackouts. Now, bless their hearts, you know, Commotion and Serval, they're actually the only ones who are really actively working on this problem in a meaningful way. It's a hard problem, and give them credit for what they're doing. While we don't disagree with their technical decisions, They're building actually really effective social organizations around this problem. They're developing operational experience that's going to produce good lessons for people who are building future blackout circumvention systems. You know, one cool thing actually coming out of Commotion to kind of sidestep the protecting user identity problem they've done is they have these privacy warning labels when you download their software. So rather than actually solving a lot of the security problems associated with the networks they're building, they're trying to be transparent about the limitations of them and hope in the hopes that users can take actions that won't get them in trouble. And kind of a plug for my co-authors, they're working this cool project called Rangzin, which is going to incorporate some interesting lessons from the delay-tolerant networking community with a system for providing a notion of reputation with an anonymity. It'll be cool to see where that goes. So to recap, mesh networks have fundamental scaling limitations, both practical ones and theoretical ones. Weird-looking equipment gets you arrested, so watch out for it. And we have to consider anonymity just like confidentiality when you're building one of these systems. So to wrap up, this is our proposal for design objectives for future descent networks for circumventing large-scale communications blackouts. They need to be resilient to disruption, have meaningful scalability properties, be built from components that aren't going to get you in trouble, and finally resist tracking by government adversaries. And we acknowledge this is a hard problem. There's good work to be done, and we hope that by presenting this, we're going to help people who are designing these systems now in the future. So if you have any questions, I'll take them now, or you can get in touch with me. Thanks. Yep.
So these are the core things that you say that networks need to have.
Sure.
I think maybe adding one more, like quality of service you expect. Because the application that you might use, maybe it is Twitter, maybe it's something larger or smaller. So perhaps that has some impact on these other things.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's in our paper we address that. We're basically meaningful scalability relative to a desired performance objective. These things get relative on the application real quick. Just didn't include that for space. Yeah.
I'm curious why you didn't talk at all about trust, because it seems like, it doesn't really matter much if you can set the network up and have people talk to one another if you don't have who you're talking to. I mean, if it's like show up in the square at 3 p.m. for demonstration food, but in fact, it's an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This doesn't help. So
right.
Don't you need to? I mean, and that seems to be really hard, right? Because there's no AI infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I touched on it very briefly. We talked about it a bit more in the paper as well. Anonymity matters and protecting identity matters, but that's only useful if you can have a notion of reputation along with it.
Right.
I agree with you. It's a hard problem. Trust needs to be in there, and it's also kind of an argument. I think there's an argument to be made also that maybe anonymity isn't what you want. Maybe you just want transparency and everything out in the open. I don't really have a good answer to that. So.
What do you mean by innocent components? You mean that all the parties who use this network
What we're referring to here is more the materials themselves, use commodity, home Wi-Fi routers to build your network as opposed to expensive commercial multi-radio mesh nodes. They might be, the latter might perform better, but it's pretty weird for a bunch of activists to be carrying around these big, units with lots of antennas.
I have another question. What happens if you promote your network and then some odd or bad people just come and join your network and then they can break any.
Yeah, I think that gets to Nick's question as well. How do you trust the members of your network? I hate to keep saying I don't know, but that's like a core problem with a lot of these systems when you're building infrastructure. And
what I mean is that you don't need to trust people in your network. You need to trust your protocol. So you need to have a protocol that can get them out. You don't need to find them and kill them.
So you're talking about providing security with the protocol? Yeah, that's another approach. And again, part of our motivation for writing this is that people have tried to build mesh networks and then bolt security on top of them, and then it just doesn't work. That's the problem that we're kind of arguing against. People need to pay attention to this, and before you put out a system that you are advertising for activists to use, you have to solve that particular problem. It's a hard one. Yeah?
So you mentioned a couple of mesh networking systems. Do you have a sense of how many of them are deployed in the field?
That's an excellent question. So here's the thing about mesh networks. They've been around for a long time, and interest comes and goes. Like I said, Yahel's deployed one. I've deployed one. I think at this point, Commotion has deployed a larger mesh network than I have, but not larger than Yahel's. There are a few out there. It's really hard to make them work in practice. So typically, they start, and you add 10 nodes, and you issue a press release, and it's really great. But then to get to 50 or 100 or communicate with a lot of people, it gets really hard really fast. So you'll see lots of mesh network pilot projects. You won't see very many operational mesh networks. And there are a few really large ones. There's like the Athens Wireless Network. There's Freifunk. But they call themselves mesh networks. They use mesh routing protocols, but they look a lot more like traditional wireless networks. There's infrastructure. There's an organization, a team around that plans them, all kinds of stuff like that. I'm happy to talk more about this if you like.
The U.S. military is also using them in production.
True.
So EPLRS and other such things.
That's true, yeah. This is common stuff for militaries. But, of course, they're using very high-end gear. So, yeah.
So, in your mind, what is the perfect innocuous component?
A cell phone is a perfect innocuous component. Everyone has one, and there's plenty of uses that aren't going to get you in trouble.
So, don't you have a lot of heterogeneity in cell phones? Like, some people have smartphones, some people have laptop phones.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a lot of how would you tackle that?
Some of the ways this has been tackled is you say we're only going to support Android phones. We're only going to support Android phones that we've rooted and done this. Commotion tries to get around this. You know, if we go back to that slide on the internet in the box, or internet suitcase rather, they have the Wi-Fi equipment that they provide, and then they try to support, you know, like that feature phone over there with a cellular network. And they try to introduce that. There's so many problems with running cellular networks as an activist. I mean, GSM is what they use, and that's just fundamentally broken from a security standpoint. So that's the way that some people have tried to get around the heterogeneity question. Yeah?
It seems like there are two models for mesh networking that I've heard about. One of them is, there is no internet anymore. Let's rebuild a tiny little internet in our local area.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is, there is an internet, and we'd really like to get there, but it's kind of hard now. So we have a connection here and a connection here, and we have this big wireless network that lets users here reach the connections here so they can get to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense in terms of the deployed projects like Commotion? Which one are they focusing on? Are people still trying to do both?
They're trying to do both, is my understanding. I mean, if there's anyone from Commotion in the room, you should answer that. That they're still trying to do both. Their deployed networks all have internet access. They have one in Red Hook and in Detroit. They're also doing some interesting stuff about applications that run on inside the mesh for, like, I think something like reporting, some kind of community organizing application they've built. They're trying to do both.
Because it seems like you use the internet to get to the Facebook group that everybody's already gotten to and everybody already trusts.
Yep.
Because it's been around for 6 years, could solve a lot of the reputation pseudonymity problems, and you would still want encryption/anonymity/privacy for reaching the internet.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, a lot of the problem for shutting down the internet is a big problem because activists organize using Twitter, Facebook, whatever, and these are all services based outside Egypt, Syria, China, whatever. So getting internet access is like a really big deal. And you can imagine mesh networks that also incorporate satellite internet to get access. I don't know, there are ways you can get around this at small scales.
And you can imagine that intranet networks can help you, because maybe the government shut down the internet, but they are not going to shut down the internet because it's, bank applications, maybe commercial applications on them, so they are not going to shut down.
I mean, I would argue, I mean, evidence suggests otherwise. People do.
I think it's also true for China.
I would just say that, I mean, governments do shut down the internet at large scales. And that's the problem that we're focusing on. Any other questions? Are we ready for lunch? We have a few more minutes.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks.